Hi, thanks for coming on, Mel. I shall start with an introduction, which I'm hoping is right, but can contradict me at the end if not. So Mel was diagnosed with type 1 at the age of 13. She was represented plus captained for her country Wales as an international level athlete, all whilst navigating life with type 1. She has also been involved in many campaigns and continues to advocate for better care. On top of all of this and her career as a dietitian, Mel is also a mum of what I suspect is a very lively young child.
How did you know?
It's as if I've been stalking you. Welcome, Mel, and lovely to chat.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, how are you today? Is it hot where you are?
Oh, it has been boiling, and I literally stepped off the plane from Turkey yesterday morning to find that it was just as warm here. So I'm not sure what that's about, but that's never happened before.
Least you had time to acclimatise whilst abroad. I suppose that's the only good thing. But our houses aren't quite up to it, are they, compared to there?
No, this is the thing. This is absolutely it. But we shouldn't complain because, oh yeah, this is what we've been waiting for summer. So no, it is nice. Yeah. So it's been a good day. So obviously kicking off Diabetes Week this week. So today we had a wonderful visit from the Minister for Health in Wales to come and see our Diabetes Education and Dietetic Service to see what we offer to support people living with diabetes and at risk of diabetes. So that was really
Oh,
nice.
wow.
Good way. Oh, yeah, quite an exciting way to start the
I was going
week.
to say, a busy woman, a busy woman. Well, we usually start off with what we call 90-second questions, but they always take a lot longer than 90 seconds. But they're a bit sort of quick fire questions. So I'm going to hand over to Tony, who hopefully is his mic and everything is working as well, for the 90-second questions.
Hi, Mel.
Hello, lovely.
Hi there. So I'm going to take you through, as like I said, some of our quick fire questions. We'll start off, we already answered this question, but we'll start with it anyway, so you can formally introduce yourself again with your name and occupation.
Okay. Sorry, you cut out then. I heard you needed me to introduce myself as well, Mel Stevenson Gray, and then was there a second part to that?
Yes, and your occupation.
Okay, so I'm a diabetes specialist dietitian.
Perfect. And when were you diagnosed and how old are you at the time?
I was diagnosed back in 2001, so at the age of 13. So I've lived with type 1 diabetes for 22 years now.
Wow, that's you're racking up the points.
Yeah, that's it. Professional at it now.
And do you finger prick or use smart technology when you check your glucose?
I use smart technology because I'm on an automated insulin pump, but I find that probably from my days in athletics that I have good awareness of what's going on in my body. So if the two for some reason don't match up, then I still do finger pricks just to kind of confirm every now and again, really.
And here's a fun one for you. When you would finger prick, you know, all the time, more frequently, did you change the mindsets every day?
Well, in the early days, it was challenging. However, I'm lucky that I had one of those, I've got one of those barrel lancets. So you've got quite a few needles in one. So I feel like that is the secret weapon for changing it more often than Christmas.
That's a question to tell if someone's lying, actually. Because if they say, "Oh yeah, every single time," then you know, maybe tell a little bit of a lie. You don't seem to do those ones as often, though. The sort of barrel six and one type of thing. It's just something that people used to get and don't get anymore so much.
Oh, I'm so sorry. The line is really difficult to hear you on. Would you mind saying that again?
Oh, sorry, can you hear me any better now?
You're kind of like underwater, I would describe it as.
Oh, no, I'm going to drop off and try and pick back up. Would you be okay to continue, Flipper?
I would, except I'm on my phone and I haven't got the, just hold on 1 second, because I'm going to have to get the questions up because I was using something else. I guess speaker chat, and then I can definitely pick up where we were. I'm now seeing the okay, next question. You've already answered this, but do you use pens or pump, and what do you prefer about whichever you're using and why?
Okay, so I've been using an insulin pump for the last 15 years. So I did still spend a good amount of time on pens. And I think there can be advantages. I used to quite like, the kind of security of having that kind of constant background insulin. But I just find that I can just be a lot more refined with my insulin dosages on the pump. Yeah. And that was before I got the automated pump. And now, yeah, I wouldn't look back to injections, but I appreciate that they work for, you know, different ways and different people. So,
And what symptoms do you have when you're hypo?
Oh, that's a good question. So I find that the probably most dominant symptom is that I feel quite trembly. So not necessarily to look at initially, but I can feel that kind of vibrating, trembly feeling coming on, like you're kind of falling a little bit, that kind of strange raised heart rate, that kind of feeling. And then maybe as things go on, a bit of kind of slowing down of thoughts and a bit of confusion then.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? And now this question I always like, because I don't think I feel. So do you have symptoms when you're hyper, when you're high? I do.
Yeah, I appreciate it's an unusual one. Not everybody does. But yeah, I'm really symptomatic when I'm high. And I'm really symptomatic when I start producing ketones as well, which is annoying, but handy very much so at the same time. Because then obviously it alerts me that if I start to feel like I've got ketones coming on, this isn't just your regular high that happens every now and again. This is something a bit more serious. So I do, yeah.
Well, I find it quite funny because I don't. And the only times I've not had ketones lots, it's only because I'm ill and I'm starting to feel really nauseous. And then it suddenly occurs to me, oh, maybe I should check for ketones.
That ketone-y nausea feeling is not pleasant at all.
What is your go-to hypo treatment?
Well, this is something that's kind of changed, I guess, over the years. So when back in the day when I was diagnosed, they used to recommend Lucozade as your first line. And I got on well with that for a long time. But then when the formulation changed for me, I just thought, no, that can't be. When you're hypo, maybe it's the middle of the night, you're trying to work out how much you need to drink. Things just felt a little bit off kilter then. So because of the athletics kind of really, I used to find that I needed something very, very quick. So it always had to be liquid. Whereas I found, because I've slowed down a little bit since having my baby, I can get away with like Skittles sometimes as well. But glucose juice is my go-to that I carry wherever I go.
Oh, like the little shots?
Yeah, I do. Because I found, again, when I was training more frequently, I needed more than the 15 grams to treat the to treat the hypos. Whereas now I need 15 and to see what's going on. So I find that it helps that I don't overeat, because that hypo brain can be a tricky thing.
Yeah. Oh, no. Tell me about it. So which is worse for you, being high or being low? Which do you dislike?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I find the lows most frustrating because, you know, you're going about your business, enjoying your day, and all of a sudden they decide to kind of hit you with a low. But I think I find the highs scarier. So equally unpleasant, but different feelings for both.
Okay, and I think Tony's back. Tony, do you want to carry on for the last few questions?
Yeah, can you hear me now? I've connected some headphones.
You sound
that's
like
better.
You've come out from under the sea.
That's so much better.
Oh,
thank
great.
You.
That's,
I was just having a little swim, you see, you know, with how hot it's been.
It leaves at the seaside, not you.
Oh, lovely.
I'll let you carry on, Tony.
Perfect. Great. So, I'm sorry, which one were we at?
I've
there?
Just done, which is worse, highs or lows? So we're about... I shall ask you a question, Mel, and then Tony can work out which question we're on. Can you say one thing that you like about diabetes or having diabetes?
I think there's a few things I like about it, but probably one of them is that it's motivated me to do things that I probably wouldn't have done if I hadn't been diagnosed. So, and given me opportunities that I certainly wouldn't have come across otherwise. So it's been it's not, you know, when you're diagnosed with type 1, you're not sure what experience you're gonna have, are you? But I think it's kind of helped me appreciate my health quite a lot as well. So yeah, there are positives. I know people find it a bit dark when you say that there's positives of living with diabetes, but you've got to look at the good side of things as well, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. That was such a lovely response. Mm. I feel bad about the next question, which is something that you don't like about diabetes. Hopefully not something that will get you down too much.
So I think I always had a really good relationship with my diabetes, and I think that the athletics really helped that. But I started to quite dislike my diabetes after I had my baby, because I found that it was such a burden to kind of manage whilst running around after a little person or trying to look after them. So I found then I really kind of struggled with the burden of it then. But thankfully that's kind of, you know, passed now. Things have gotten easier. So I think when life becomes more complex, looking after your diabetes at the same time also becomes more complex. So I don't like that.
Yeah, I can imagine it as sort of like competing priorities, sort of things are sort of jostling for what's going to take more of your attention. So it's sort of natural that, yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky, and things like breastfeeding are really challenging with diabetes. So I think, and they're things that nobody can prepare you for until you get into those moments. So I think, yeah, that tested my relationship with my diabetes quite a lot.
And here's another slightly fun question. What are your thoughts on the smell of insulin?
I'm going to share this story, and I might sound a little bit strange, but I was at a kid's party a few months ago and I smelled insulin and thought, I don't think it's mine, because, you know, unless you do a set change, you don't really smell it on yourself if you were in a pump. And I kind of looked up and the person next to me had their insulin pen out and they had type 1 diabetes, and we got talking from it, but it was that initial smell that kind of alerted me to a potential new friend. So yeah, I think it's not unpleasant or pleasant, really.
Oh, that's brilliant. I always feel like people with diabetes are always fast friends.
I think so too. It's thankfully, very much thankfully, there's not many people that I've met where I've kind of said, oh, hello, I'm in the same boat, and they've kind of thought me strange. So yeah, usually it's a good thing. It's a positive to meet somebody else in the wild, as it were. I certainly enjoy it.
Okay, and just one last one before we get into some more stories around your diagnosis and your journey. If you were on a deserted island, what three things would you take? And you don't have to bother about any diabetes things, just any fun old things that you want to have on your deserted island.
Oh, gosh. I would probably take my set of Harry Potter audiobooks. I would take... some food, because I do really enjoy food, and I would take a camera as well, because I really enjoy photography.
Yeah, you're going to want some memories when you get off, get them printed out when you get home.
Yeah, if I ever get rescued, then at least I've got something to show for my time.
Excellent, thanks, Mel. So hopefully that gives those listening just a little bit of a background on you and some little bits of information. So Flipper's going to take back over now to chat through your diagnosis.
Oh, lovely. Thank you, Tony.
Yes. Well, hi. That was really interesting. Yours were really good things to take to the desert island. I really struggled.
Oh, wait, thank you.
I'm now thinking camera, camera, if I'm ever asked again, camera. So we're just going to do sort of a little chat about, because you were 13 when you were diagnosed, I'm assuming you remember that time. And I'm just wondering how it came about, what symptoms you had.
I was in high school at the time, so I think the symptom that was probably most prevalent initially and that kept me off school was the tiredness, that I just remember sleeping all through the day and being at my grandmother's and her having to wake me up to eat and just not having the energy, going back to sleep then, waking up in the middle of the night to go for a wee all the time, but then also, you know, sticking my head under the tap because you just can't quench that thirst. You and I didn't notice that I'd lost weight at the time, which is strange because I am quite tall, but I think we found out when I got diagnosed. But with those symptoms and most so the fatigue, my mum took me to the GP just to kind of see what might be going on. Didn't think for a second about diabetes, just knew that I was feeling really, really ropey. And so the GP gave us a ring really shortly afterwards and said, you know, dash to the hospital. And then I was diagnosed that same day and sent home that same night then, because I had a diabetes team that were really, the Peds diabetes team in Cardiff were really forward thinking. So they were very much of the opinion, I believe, that if you're well enough to go home and you're in a position, you know, to safely do so, then it might reduce some of the trauma of diagnosis. And then my diabetes nurses came to my house the next day then to do all of the teaching part. But I would wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment, that I don't look back on it, even though what I was diagnosed with was traumatic because it was life changing. Mm-hmm. The experience health could have been so much worse.
Oh no. So it sounds like you picked up relatively quickly.
I don't know, because I don't know what my blood glucose levels were when I was diagnosed. I couldn't say. I'd say based on my diabetes knowledge now, things had gotten pretty severe. But what they were, I don't know. And I guess I responded well to insulin as well. Yeah. So I certainly wasn't in DKA or anything like that, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah. And it's quite difficult remembering back. I know myself, somebody said that and I'm like, I know it wasn't long, but I can't tell you how long.
And you know, when you're feeling so unwell at that point of diagnosis, your memory just isn't the same as it would be when you're well either, is it? So it's a tricky one.
So how did the diagnosis affect your sort of life, the changes that came with it? What sort of sticks in your mind?
So I remember that my diabetes nurses went into my school before I went back and they spoke to my my teachers, and I think they kind of spoke with me about not ever feeling ashamed of living with diabetes, that I just kind of, not a sense that I needed to get on with it, but that I certainly didn't need to apologize for having it. And so that was a huge thing, because they did such a great kind of education piece, I suppose, with my teachers. I was never excluded from anything. And I think very much that my friends took their cue from me. So whilst I worked to try and accept having type 1 and this new diagnosis, they just kind of got on with being my friends. So I was never bullied, never felt kind of self-conscious about it or anything like that. Obviously it takes time to get back to school life and having to kind of, in those days, I think the medical plans were a little bit different, hopefully, to now. Because I remember that you had to go in, I had to go and do my insulin and test my glucose levels, including if I was having a hypo, in the school office. So hopefully now children aren't wandering around the corridors kind of hypo, but we are talking over two decades ago, in fairness. It was a big moment. It was shocking. It was upsetting. But I think I had a good team around me of support.
And at that point, were you really into your athletics at that point? I'm not sure at what age you became. I mean, I'm imagining, and this is somebody who's not athletic at all, and know people at school who were athletic. They were always athletic and always very good at athletics. From an early age, it seemed to me.
Oh, I felt like that scene, the cross-country runners. I remember thinking, why does it come so naturally to them? Why is it so difficult for me? But no, I wasn't an athlete at all. I wasn't doing any kind of athletics, had never done it before, had done the compulsory cross-country, but wasn't any good at it, but, you know, gave it a go anyway. Mm-hmm. So I didn't take up athletics until 3 years after I was diagnosed, because in Cardiff, where I'm based, we have quite a good grassroots scheme. So all of the schools, the high schools from Cardiff and Vale, all kind of come together at grassroots competitions. Mm-hmm. And I just found that I really enjoyed it. Not initially that I was particularly good at it, but that I just found that, you know, when you're diagnosed with type 1, even though this wasn't the focus of my diabetes team, your mind goes to thinking that there's a lot of things that you can't mm-hmm. do, that your body perhaps let you down in some way, or you're thinking about, yeah, this long list of things. You know, 20 years ago, we used to have conversations around, you couldn't be a paramedic, you couldn't be a boxer, you couldn't do this, that, and the other. So I think initially athletics probably represented something that I could do and that my body was doing well at, and didn't remind me of not being on par or anything like that.
Oh, no, that's it. And it sounds like you had a really supportive team, plus friends, etc. So did you have any sort of like hiccups or whatever? I watched back I think it was the TED talk that you gave.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's where my stalking started. And you mentioned in there that you found injecting in public quite challenging.
Yeah, I think being an athlete and injecting in warm up areas, people grow a little bit suspicious around what you're injecting and why. And there was a lot less awareness in those days as well. Other challenges included when I was in transition clinic, so going from 16 onwards, you know, leaving peds. I'd still be there now if I could be, because it was so lovely. I really struggled with transitional care and just kind of had not so helpful comments around, you know, do you really need to do the athletics, because it makes your diabetes more complicated to manage. And I don't think that there was necessarily an understanding of the importance of having an identity alongside your diabetes back then, and there was certainly no real acceptance that diabetes needed psychological support as well as that physical support too. And then on occasions there have been track judges in the warm-up area. When I've had my insulin pump on, they've accused me of having a music device on, because they're banned in the warm-up area because you can't hear the announcements. But I think probably I found it more challenging perhaps as an adult, because sometimes people don't have a filter and they don't think that you might not want to know about a terrible story that happened to somebody else.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not laughing because something awful happened to their mother's parents' dog. It's more that, you know, people are strange on what they choose to share.
What they feel is appropriate.
Yes, absolutely.
So you've mentioned the sort of support that you got from your peds team sound amazing. How did your parents cope at the time? Because it must have been really challenging for them, and I'm sure they were sort of beavering away in the background, trying not to let you know that they were.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that going on, because I'll be honest with you, I've never really been brave enough to go into great detail about how they found it. And I think it probably wasn't until I was an adult that I selfishly realised that it wasn't a condition that was just affecting me, that it was also going to affect them, because they would have had thoughts, hopes, dreams that, you know, may have felt had altered because of the diagnosis. And, you know, to see your child going through something like that and not being able to take it away, that is something that they shared with me. But I think in their own ways, they both kind of, like my mum found ways to help me celebrate my diabetes anniversary. So that was really significant, because that could have been a really sad day otherwise, kind of remembering the day that life changed so much. much. And I think my mum was really keen never to make me feel apologetic about my diabetes. Mm. So never having to kind of excuse myself because I was doing my injections, or I'm always happy to talk about diabetes, but I never felt any kind of pressure if I hadn't wanted to. I've always felt like I could be open about it, which I think is really important.
No, parents are, I would like to say, unsung heroes, which they are, but they're also sung heroes as well, in that, because I can't imagine what they're doing in the background, the preparations, and like, oh yes, of course you can go on that 2-day Outward Bound course.
Absolutely. And, you know, keeping that fear from you as well, as you say, because I went away a lot with international athletics. And yes, now I look back, I always had to stay in the room opposite the medical person. But other than that, I didn't notice anything different. So, but I'm sure, as you say, they were on tenterhooks the whole time I was away.
Well, it's really interesting. I'm going to pass you back. We're going to do a bit of a tag team thing here. So I'm just going to pass you back to Tony, who's just going to talk to you a bit about your journey through your treatment of your diabetes. So, Tony, are you there?
Yeah, so like Flapper said, we're going to sort of chat through the journey. So just to start things off, we've spoken a little bit about the diagnosis and what things were like at that point in time, and obviously sort of transition into athletics and things. Let's take it back a little bit again. So how did you manage your diabetes at diagnosis, as in what sort of, what was the treatment like?
So I went straight on to 2 injections a day of mixed insulin, and I realised kind of when one of my friends was literally diagnosed a couple of months before me, and she was still on the draw-up syringes. So I realised that I actually got lucky when I was diagnosed that I could go on to, you know, the newfangled, as they were, pens in different colours. And then I think within a couple of years, maybe a year or two, it just wasn't cutting it. And, you know, being a teenager, hormones, athletics, eventually I needed to go on to 4 injections a day. And then I started becoming insulin resistant at about 19, 20. So was on a lot more injections then, doing what we didn't really kind of recognize correction doses back then. But that's really what I was doing, because my blood sugars had taken a bit of a nosedive, really.
And then how did it progress from there? So you're saying that is a lot. I mean, a lot of people on MDI may be talking 5, 6, sometimes even 7, but 10 is an awful lot. That's obviously taking a lot of time out of your day, and must have been quite stressful as well. How did you transition away from that? Was there any solution?
Yeah, it was hugely stressful, because I felt so unwell with it as well. So I remember that we agreed, although very grudgingly, because I never wanted an insulin pump initially, which is, you know, crazy to think now with how much I love it. But I think we just kind of agreed, myself and I transitioned early out of the transitional team because it just didn't suit me, and went to adults. And I agreed to go on to metformin tablets to kind of see if that would help with the insulin resistance. And if I trialed that, then I could, you know, work towards having an insulin pump then. So that was quite a difficult transition again, because I needed to stop athletics for them to get the basal rates right. And the infusion sets, so the needles that we wear for the insulin pumps, weren't as kind of robust as they are now. And my insulin pump wasn't waterproof. So all in all, it was quite a challenging time initially. And the transition took about 3 months, which would be a wild thought now. But yeah, it was a good while before I started feeling better and feeling myself again.
Wow. So how would you say, like, looking back now, it's helped your everyday life? What are the pros and cons of having the technology compared to what things look for, beyond, of course, the obvious 10 injections a day? What other sort of pros and cons are there?
So I think what I noticed fairly early on, and particularly in relation to the athletics, was that when you do the injections, they're in. So you're taking quite large, like relatively speaking, large volumes of insulin. And the only way to counteract those then is to, you know, match it with the carbohydrates. Whereas with the insulin pumps and doing exercise, sport, anything else, it just means that I can be much more responsive. It's not so much that I need to constantly be doing something, but if I know that I'm planning exercise, then I can plan that with my pump as well. Whereas with the injections, you know, you need your basal, you need your boluses for food. And so it was just more complicated in a different way, I think, being on injections. Whereas being on an instant pump, I've just got a bit more control. And my HbA1c improved quite significantly as well. And just being able to kind of have more in-depth conversations with the diabetes team. Because when I was on injections before and using, you know, the good old-fashioned paper diaries, you've got your HbA1c, but that only tells part of the story. Whereas I used a combination, for example, when I was pregnant, of time in range and HbA1c to manage my diabetes, which gave a bit more of an overall picture. And I was pregnant during the pandemic, so having diabetes technology meant that we could speak on the phone rather than needing to get a pregnant woman with type 1 into the hospital all the time. So there have been, yeah, over kind of the last 10 years or so, there have been quite a few advantages that I hadn't considered with a pump.
And have there been any other sort of like memorable moments, sort of like ups and downs, sort of highs and lows over the years, and like how did you tackle them?
Yeah, I think there have been. I think certainly since the pandemic, so I caught COVID because I was working, you know, when things kind of kicked off, and so kind of getting that with diabetes was really challenging, and needing to manage, you know, the fallout from that. A couple of months ago, I had my very first bout of DKA, unfortunately. So that was a huge, huge challenge, I think, both mentally and physically, because it was a really nasty bout of tonsillitis that became systemic, that, yeah, just turned, kind of flipped the switch and kind of drove me towards DKA then, unfortunately. So yeah, I think you're kind of reminded of not feeling quite as invincible as you'd like to be when those things happen. But then equally, over the years, kind of blogging, doing social media, doing volunteering, I've been able to meet other people with diabetes, which dramatically lowers the burden and normalizes living with the condition. I've been, you know, been able to travel on my own, which is really liberating, I think, when you're living with diabetes, because, you know, you have to be so well organized. But, and, you know, traveling on your own is a scary thing anyway, but doing it with diabetes, I think, is that additional challenge. But yeah, I think it's kind of shown me what I can achieve and what I can kind of still do with living with a condition. And it's, over the years as well, it's made me really highly motivated. So I think I've always felt like I wanted to achieve as much or as like more than somebody not living with diabetes as well.
And I think it seems as well, just from listening to the way that you speak, that you take everything in your stride and sort of try to take a positive away from it all, which is really nice. So it's like a real sort of can-do attitude, as opposed to being a sort of like defeatist over it.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think that I felt from a young age that if I made an enemy of my diabetes, we just weren't going to get on. You know, it's hard to get on with something that you don't like, whereas I've tried to kind of foster a positive relationship as much as I can. I think, you know, going back to when we were talking about the pediatric diabetes team, it probably all started there, because when I said to them, you know, 3 years after diagnosis, I want to do athletics, they didn't say no, or that's going to be difficult or anything like that. It was just that, as you say, that can-do attitude, just doing it safely and preparing for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about sort of like looking back, is there anything that you wish you would have known at the beginning when you were newly diagnosed that you know now?
Oh gosh, I think what I would have liked to have known, there's probably a couple of things, but I'll keep it brief. I think I'd have liked to have known how much diabetes technology was going to change, because I think for me, I knew fairly early on that injections weren't working as well as they should have been for me. But when you don't know that technology is coming down the pipeline, you kind of think, oh gosh, is this what life is going to be like? This is really difficult. So I think with new technology has brought a lot of new hope, which has been really good. That, you know, of course we all want the cure for type 1 diabetes, but technology is an incredible thing to help us manage it in the interim. And then I think I would have liked to have known that there could be, that there was potential for good things to come from living with diabetes as well. That I probably wouldn't have stopped to think about that in, you know, in the months after diagnosis. And then finally, I think I would say that how important acceptance of diabetes, and that this is the kind of the present and the future, as it were, because I remember after being diagnosed that, you know, very well-meaning people used to cut out articles on diabetes cures, in, you know, commas, from the newspapers, as if a cure was 10 minutes away type of thing. And I think if you're constantly focused on the cure and not living today and tomorrow, you can't, it's so hard to look after yourself properly. Whereas I think when I started to accept that, you know, this is where things are, I also accepted that I needed to look after myself, you know, in the now, because I want to have a future that's as free of complications as I possibly can.
Oh, those are all great answers. And like you were saying, I mean, I don't think anyone's ever said that before about the, like, what vision that you saw of New York telling yourself would be like, how technology will change and how that will sort of make things easier, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some technology you can kind of think now, like, for example, I like my insulin pump, but I'd love it if it was a little bit smaller, for example. Whereas things like, you know, flash glucose monitoring, I couldn't even have imagined that in my wildest dreams, that, you know, you're just going to scan your diabetes, your glucose levels. So, yeah, I think it's been, as I say, it's been very hopeful having the different kind of types of technology and the updates and different types of insulin that have updated as well. And I find that it gives a lot of hope to children too. So it's really nice to kind of to see that some children will barely know injections because they're going straight onto insulin pumps, which is just a lot easier, hopefully, for them.
Yeah, it's like a totally different world. And I loved it, but the way you described that, they're sort of scan your diabetes levels, even just hearing you say that, it still sounds like magic, actually, when you actually break it down to what you're physically doing. It's so much easier.
Yeah, and, you know, automated pumps as well. I think I thought that was going to be a lot further off than it actually was. Although, you know, I think I've been patient waiting 20 years or so. But yeah, I think that seemed a little bit kind of into the future, but here we are.
So let's move on and talk a little bit more about the advocacy work that you've been involved in. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about what initiatives you've been involved in over the years?
Oh goodness, okay. So when I really struggled with my transition from injections to pumps, I'd not long won a British medal. So I contacted Diabetes UK, and part of it was kind of frustration, really, not because they'd done anything wrong, but I was so frustrated at seeing all of the negative stories in the press about what people with diabetes couldn't do. And I wanted to kind of share a positive story that we are still doing positive things. And so I started off as a media ambassador doing that for Diabetes UK. Then that moved on to facilitating family days. So that was a fantastic experience, getting to train with other people with diabetes to put on events for children, their siblings and parents as well. And then that kind of will sometimes that kind of morph then into campaigns like the 4Ts campaign, so making sure that people are aware of, you know, the symptoms of type 1. And then most recently then I've been working a lot to support women planning pregnancy, going through pregnancy with diabetes and aftercare as well. So I'm in the process with a very well rounded team of creating the global guidelines for pregnancy and diabetes. So that's been a really good experience, because pregnancy was really difficult for me. So being able to kind of turn my experiences into something meaningful has been really therapeutic, and I've been grateful for that. And then I also am on the board of trustees for Diabetes UK, so as a patient representative. And that's been nearly 3 years now, and has been a really amazing opportunity to kind of get to the heart of, you know, one of the big charities, and to kind of help direct where patients feel that the charity should be going. So that's included things like talking about women's health, talking about what we can do to support people of ethnicity to kind of, because diabetes, particularly in type 2, disproportionately affects people of ethnicity. So putting more of a focus from research point of view, awareness point of view, numerous kind of physical activity campaigns as well, because I appreciate that it's not easy to do sport or be active living with diabetes when you're trying to balance, you know, all your blood sugars out. So I suppose that comes from a frustration that I'm aware that people with diabetes are quite often told to exercise, but they're not always told how. So that's been quite a close thing to my heart. And then finally, access to diabetes technology as well. So I feel very grateful for having access to it myself, but I appreciate that, you know, it can still be a bit of a postcode lottery as to what people get, when people get it. And I feel that it just should be widely available if people want it, really.
Oh, wow, that is such a huge variety of, it's like so much. The length and breadth of your advocacy work is pretty astounding, actually. So you spoke a lot there about, you know, like the difficulties that you had your own pregnancy. So that's sort of you taking from your lived experience and saying, do you know what, other people can learn from this, from, and you can help other people with that, the knowledge that you've gained. But what other reasons are there that keep you motivated in doing all of that work?
I think there's a huge element of, I did the athletics and things look positive from that point of view. I'm actually probably still somebody who's had a really tough time with their diabetes, and I just don't want that for other people. I want people to have a much easier journey than I've had. So that was what kind of pushed me into becoming a diabetes dietitian. I think I really like people as well, and I like the idea of people being able to fulfill their potential. So I think being able to put kind of guidelines in place, policies in place to protect people with diabetes and to guide them is a really valuable thing for me to do, because I'm somebody who believes, and not to get, you know, too deep on it, but when you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, I'm acutely aware that things could go in a very different direction. And for some people, you know, frighteningly, it has. And so I think that you almost get given extra time when you're diagnosed with type 1. And I've always wanted to do something valuable with that time, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an amazing point that you've made there. Yes, honestly, it's genuinely inspirational, the amount of stuff you've done. So, I mean, well done. I just think that's absolutely amazing.
Oh, that's very kind. But it's very much from the point of view of when things go wrong for me, I think my coping mechanism is to make sure that it doesn't happen for other people. So, where I can do that, then I do.
And that's a pretty good motivation to have, sort of thinking of for other people as well. What about talking more about the side of peer support? We have spoken a little bit about this. How important do you think peer support is for people with long-term conditions?
Oh my goodness, I think peer support is absolutely essential, particularly in a condition like type 1 diabetes, because I don't think we're there with the psychological support yet. I've been banging this drum for well over a decade that I'd love to see psychologists in the team with our diabetes nurses, our consultants, our dietitians, and we're just not there yet. And so it's not that peer support replaces psychology, but I think it certainly it just provides so many benefits for people. And it's one of those things, you know, I know that you'll all get it, but to sit down at a table surrounded by people who are also carb counting, finger pricking, injecting, pumping, it's just such a liberating feeling that you don't feel like the odd one out. Nobody's looking at you. You're just kind of able to be yourself and get on with it. And peer support just brings all of those values to the surface, really. And that shared experience as well, that, you know, we were joking earlier about seeing somebody with diabetes in the wild. I think that's why we have that instant connection, because we've just been through, yes, individual journeys, but also a shared journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say that it's like we speak a different language that only we can understand.
Oh, I think so.
But it's a shared language.
Yeah, definitely. And we've got all of these diabetes abbreviations as well, haven't we? So I think sometimes it is technically a different language.
Yeah, quite literally sometimes.
Yeah.
So we're going to move on a little bit more to talk about sort of your career in athletics a bit more. Flipper, are you
well,
going to be asking
what
some
I was thinking of doing, Tony, because I'm just going to mix this up. Tony doesn't know I'm going to do this, because you've mentioned your pregnancy and the difficulty and the fact that you're working on guidelines, etc. I was just thinking, are you okay if we have a little bit of a chat about your pregnancy?
Yeah, of course.
And I hope Tony's okay with the change of schedule there, because we did have athletics next, but it just seemed a good follow on from what you were saying.
Okay,
yeah.
No problem.
So you've had a daughter during the pandemic, which hats off to anybody who has a baby, full stop. And I kneel at your feet if you've got type one and have a baby. Because, oh my goodness, you said. So if you don't mind me asking, and just sort of mosey off a question if you think I'm getting, I don't think anything is too personal, but I'm quite fine, whatever. So what stage did you start discussing or mentioning your pregnancy to your team? Because I know every time, if you're a woman, you go to clinic, they ask you about pregnancy. They don't, not worry about any other part of you being a female, but pregnancy.
Yeah, literally from, yes, kind of my high teens, that was the conversation. Yes. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, no, I can't look after myself yet, let alone a little person. But yeah, no, I was aware that I needed, my HbA1c was okay, but I was aware that I could have done a bit more tweaking just to get it that little bit lower. And so I probably gave them a year or two's notice that this was something I was starting to consider. Mm-hmm. Not that I was imminently planning, but certainly something that I needed to consider. And I think that was really important. And now I kind of look back, because you kind of need to get into particular habits, I think, to maintain a particular HbA1c. And so doing that whilst pregnant is really difficult because of the insulin resistance. So I think doing my best to try and form those really good habits before I became pregnant just kind of made them a bit more automatic, really. And to kind of know, I don't know if you can really know what to expect with pregnancy, but as far as you can, you know, like I needed to start on a higher dose of folic acid to kind of support, yeah, reducing kind of complications for me and the baby. So, you know, that is better done a year in advance as well. So it's all of those little things with the planning that you may or may not be aware of until you talk to the team, I think.
Yeah. That you saying a year ahead with the folic acid, I'd never realised that. Not that I've ever been pregnant, but in my head, I'd have thought, oh, a few months, be fine. And is there anything particularly different? And I appreciate that there's the HbA1c and trying to get that down if you can and stable. But apart from that, do you think there's anything particularly different for somebody with type 1 than people without?
In their preparation stages? Well, I guess some of the statistics might say that there's a higher risk of things like miscarriage, particularly if blood sugars are, you know, more erratic. So I think it can't be kind of understated how much of an impact that diabetes can have. So it is quite a big thing there. But you've also got, you know, the things that everybody else would have. So wanting to, for you and your partner to be in a healthy place, kind of nutritionally, health-wise, blood pressure-wise. So, but yeah, it's a funny thing because you don't really get much time to think about the things that other people would think about during pregnancy, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So I remember I was probably about, late 20s, early 30 weeks pregnant before I read just a pregnancy book that wasn't diabetes and pregnancy, because it just didn't occur to me that, you know,
guess that you were also that's what people did.
I thought, oh gosh, I think I need to do a bit of research on this, you know, what the general process is, you know, of giving birth as well as the diabetes side.
I was going to say, because it just seems so intense. I mean, A, the preparation, getting, you know, sort of your levels to a level where, it, you know, it's okay to start trying and whatever. But then to maintain the levels during pregnancy just seems, you know, sort of impossible levels. Do you know what I mean? But I suppose you're very motivated. You've got a good motivation.
Yeah, you definitely have, motivation wise, but honestly, I could not have accounted for the insulin resistance. I've never known anything like it, and I just didn't consider how quickly that was going to jump. So I remember probably from about 6 weeks, I really started to notice it.
Oh, wow.
And then that has huge, yeah, and it has a huge impact then on your blood sugars before, during, after meals. So, you know, you've got this really tight control that you need to manage. It was like between having a blood sugar between 4 and 6 going into a meal. And normally I'd be a bit uncomfortable of going in at 4 because I'd be thinking, oh, I'm going to hypo during the meal and the carbs aren't going to be fast acting enough and blah, 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 blah. But yeah, with pregnancy, it's, yeah, you're fighting to get down to those levels, but the insulin behaves quite differently as well. So it's almost like it takes a longer time to get to its peak, but then it acts really quickly. So it's kind of almost like learning your diabetes again, because it behaves so differently.
Oh, wow. And you're obviously a very active person, because you've mentioned athletics, etc. How did you approach that with pregnancy as well?
So I think I got very lucky about a real chance meeting, I suppose. So a few years ago, I remember saying to Diabetes UK Cymru, because I was maybe thinking about pregnancy, for the next talk on, I think it was our technology conference, I remember saying, I'd really like somebody to come and talk about diabetes and pregnancy, because nobody's ever spoken in any great detail at anything I've been before, and I really want to kind of, you know, understand more. And there was a fantastic professor called Professor Helen Murphy, who has done loads of research. Yeah. And so I heard her talk, and I remember her saying about her research, kind of saying about set amounts of carbs at meals, and also this idea of like a 15 minute or more walk after food to help with the kind of the insulin resistance, the insulin, the digestion, everything else. And so obviously we had restrictions as well during the pandemic, so but we were allowed out at that time, so I had to walk really intensely quite a lot after my meals. So sometimes it'd be 10 o'clock at night, my blood sugars might be rising, and off my husband and I would go on a walk around the neighborhood. And then I was lucky that I had a spinning bike in the house from years ago. I used to struggle with Achilles injuries, so when I couldn't get out, I would certainly get on the bike and try and do some intensity there. But intensity is very different when you've got a very large bump, because your flexibility is very different and your muscles are different as well.
Yes, I've heard about that from friends, and it all sounds very strange.
Yeah, it is. It is because, you know, as people with diabetes, I think many of us like to think we know our bodies better than
Yeah.
most, but then pregnancy changes that again.
Yeah.
So the learning curve.
Yes. And do you think being a dietitian helped how you could plan the foods that you did eat, etc., to help with either the resistance to insulin or the timings or keeping your levels?
Yeah, I think it did help hugely because I think it was, yeah, having the confidence to go with the the advice that I saw from Professor Murphy was around having, say, 20 to 30 grams of carbs for breakfast, 30 to 40 for lunch, and 30 to 40 for evening meal. And then I wasn't low carbing, so I would make up the rest of my carbs that I wanted in snacks and everything else. But then you still need those low carb snacks as well, because you know that hunger when you're pregnant is quite extreme, but you aren't always in a position because of your blood sugars, but you still want to be giving that nutrition to the baby. But because of the insulin resistance, I didn't put on huge amounts of weight. I just kind of put on the baby weight. So from a dietetic point of view, it's kind of like that reassurance that I was really nutritionally balanced. I was giving the baby what she needed, and just kind of monitoring things from that point of view. And I also found a really huge source of support in other women with type 1 diabetes that had been through it. So some of them were actually dietitians, but some were not. And just kind of that lived experience was essential, I think. It really, really helped me through. And more than anything, knowing that it was possible, knowing that they had come out healthy from their pregnancy with their babies really helped me kind of, yeah, stay motivated, not to be strict with myself in a restrictive way, but my HbA1c was, I think it was maybe 43, 45, during my pregnancy. So it kind of helped me, yeah, stay on the level and stay focused.
Oh, wow. And now I'm not going to ask you any of the gory details because I really don't want to know. But
Fair.
how did the delivery go in terms of managing it with type 1? I thought I would preface that because I'm like, I don't want to know.
It's not an easy question to ask, in fairness to you. So, I will be honest that it was a real challenge around delivery and the planning for it, because I kind of, my plan was that I wouldn't have a plan, because I think diabetes and babies are so unpredictable that I didn't want to have a plan and not go to plan, and then, you know, kind of, oh gosh, chaos ensues. I really struggled with the idea of, and obviously it's, you know, whatever the healthcare team suggests for somebody and what suits them best, but I really struggled with the idea of an induction, which is not uncommon in people with diabetes because they don't let us go to full term, because the research says, you know, to go a bit earlier is better, because there was no real clear guidance on who was going to manage my diabetes. I was aware that I wasn't allowed to eat whilst I was in labour. And my diabetes at the time just wasn't, it's not the kind of diabetes where you can fast for long periods of time. That's just not how my body works. And I also had just had this kind of instinct in the back of my mind that I thought it was going to end up as a C-section. And I thought, I'm better off being aware of that potential possibility than it being a surprise 10 minutes before. So as it turned out, it was a C-section that I needed. And it was complicated is the briefest answer. The C-section was fine, but unfortunately I developed a really severe case of eclampsia after the birth. So I was in recovery. The C-section all went fine. There was no problem with that. And the eclampsia probably was to do with a multitude of things. So yes, having diabetes, but also being a woman of ethnicity, also it being my first pregnancy. So that was a real challenge, because I think all I realized that all through my pregnancy, I thought if anything goes wrong, it's going to be my diabetes. And it kind of wasn't just my diabetes. So again, it's that shock that diabetes isn't to blame for everything.
Oh, I've never, well, this is now me. I always thought when you hear of it, and one of, I know somebody who had preeclampsia and whatever, and it didn't progress to full eclampsia, but they delivered the baby and that was what stopped it. So I always thought once the baby was delivered, do you know what I mean? That risk passed. I have no idea why that, you know, what the baby being inside does that, you know, delivering it stops. But I didn't realise you could get that once you'd actually birthed.
I know, it's quite a strange phenomenon, but I'm quite grateful that they're going to be doing quite a lot of research into it in the US, because I understand, I think, that a similar thing happened to Serena Williams and also to Alison Felix, sprinter as well. So there's obviously more to this, because I'm not comparing myself to them by any stretch, but we're, relatively speaking, we're all fit, healthy individuals. So we shouldn't have been in, you know, such kind of high risk groups. Obviously the diabetes is high risk, but there's obviously more to it that we don't quite understand. So I'm really grateful that the research is going on to find out more.
Oh goodness. And from that bit, I'll move on now from gory details. From the outside, it always seems to me with pregnancy, there's a lot of talk, like in clinics and stuff, which I suppose is like the before pregnancy, and then I hear a lot about during pregnancy. I've seen talks on pregnancy. I've heard Helen Murphy, who's amazing. But you have very little, or maybe I've just missed it, about once you've given birth and have a little thing that you're having to look after, and your hormones anyway will be in chaos. But we've got extra chaos in the hormones because you've got the diabetes. How did you manage that?
Oh my goodness. Well, this is something that I've definitely advocated strongly for with regards to the guidelines, because I wholeheartedly agree with you. You know, my diabetes team is fantastic, but the advice was to drop my basal rates by a certain amount, and that was, relatively speaking, you know, the extent of it. They checked in really regularly, don't get me wrong, but I think we need a lot more specific advice. So I'm really keen to have a better understanding of how much energy we expend when we're breastfeeding, for example. So how much do we need to take in? Because there are kind of, for people without diabetes, there are guidelines around how many extra calories you need. Truthfully, that was not enough for diabetes management wise for me personally anyway. And I don't want women to not choose their kind of preferred feeding method because of their diabetes and because of their, you know, concerns around hypos, because that's a really real fear. If you're having regular hypos, but you're also trying to get to grips becoming a new mum, oh gosh, it's a, you know, it's a lot to think about. So yes, I agree that we definitely need more information postpartum, and, you know, just kind of this awareness that I would probably say it took me a good 2 years to kind of physically, mentally recover from giving birth. And it's that old thing, I think, with diabetes, that quite often the time it takes somebody without diabetes to recover kind of doubles when you've got diabetes. But I didn't really consider it that applying to pregnancy, but for me personally it did. So yes, more information please on that.
Yeah, and it is very traumatic on a body anyway, and everything on top of that. And I suppose with you saying, like, with hypos, if you're looking after a little baby as well, the thought of having a hypo when you're in sole charge. I know I've babysat for children, for friends' children, which I know is not the same as birthing a child, do not get me wrong, but I know there I'm always really sort of paranoid, especially when they were little and babies and things, that I know I wouldn't let myself go low or near low, because I just was like, I don't want to be walking downstairs and trip or
Yeah, it's all of those extra thoughts. You're absolutely right there. And then you've also got the added complication of kind of, if you're feeding overnight or if you're just waking up with a baby overnight, we know that sleep deprivation hugely impacts our diabetes management as well. So we need to find out and have a bit more clear guidance around all of these nuances, I think. And I don't know whether it's because historically pregnancy was considered, initially, I think it wasn't always recommended for people with living with diabetes. But now that it is, let's really support people, you know, through the journey.
And I think it's also another point, I'm here going to be right on with this, it's women's health generally. We're quite often thought of as men who could have the potential to have a baby. No, but that's how medicine looks at us.
I understand
and,
you. Yeah,
and actually, we need research into women doing, you know, sort of people with the potential to have babies or have had babies.
As you say, a lot of medical modelling is based on male anatomy, absolutely, and the kind of female anatomy is considered an add-on sometimes.
Yes.
And so, as you say, we need research from kind of a pregnancy point of view, menopause point of view, menstruation point of view, because these are really key points that last a significant period of time. So absolutely, it's such an important part of diabetes through the life course. I hugely agree with you.
I was going to say, and we are 50% of the population. Now we're running over a bit, Mel. Are you okay just going on a little bit longer? I appreciate you've got a little one. I shall then go on. So do you have any tips or pointers for anybody else that you think would be really helpful if they were thinking of having a baby or helped you, like you've already said about exercising after meals and things like that? Are there anything else you'd like be your top tip?
I think don't underestimate the importance of carbohydrate kind of timings, portion sizes and overall nutrition, because I think that was what got my HbA1c into such a good place during my pregnancy. I think that being active and doing it in a way that suits you, that's safe as well. So the Active Pregnancy Foundation is a charity that I kind of work with a lot as well on a voluntary basis, and there's quite a good amount of information there that wasn't there when I was pregnant, so that's nice that there's more information out there. There's a really good book by a person living with type 1 diabetes and I believe celiac disease as well, called Ginger Vieira, and it's called Type 1 Diabetes and Pregnancy. Amazing. That was wonderful to kind of read. I read a little bit ahead, you know, spoiler alert, to see what was coming, but it's written week by week from a diabetes and pregnancy point of view, so that was a really, really good one. And there's a Carbs and Cows book on, yes, it's gestational diabetes, but it's got some really good kind of nutritional information around like low carb snacks, making the most use of kind of slow release carbohydrates as well. So I think it's kind of not overwhelming yourself, but arming yourself with that information. And, you know, if you're in a position where you've got a partner as well, my husband learned to carb count when I was pregnant. He was weighing out an awful lot of food for me, so it just took a little bit of the burden away when you're, you know, you've been working a full day, you're struggling at the end of it. And I used to be ravenous. I finished work at 4 o'clock and I was so hangry by 4:30. So having somebody to kind of support me with meals then as well was really good. I let my employer know very, very early on, because the number of diabetes appointments is quite vast, and so they could just support me from an early point of view. And then I would also say, I know Dr. Rose Stewart is doing some amazing research on diabetes, pregnancy and mental health as well, because obviously there's a huge kind of burden of managing the condition, but then also being pregnant. So I think it's being kind to yourself, getting the support that you need in terms of during your pregnancy, after your pregnancy as well.
Yeah, and I can also see from the outside looking in the emotional side as well. Because not only, you've also in the back of your mind got, I'm growing a little person here. Anything you do is affecting that little person. That is so helpful, Mel. That was so good. Thank you so much for that. We'll do, I'm going to now surprise Tony and say, do you want to start talking a bit about athletics with Mel?
Perfect, yeah, and like Flipper says, I know obviously we are sort of running to overtime a little bit here, so obviously answer with as much or as little detail as you like or have time to, of course. So the first thing I just wanted to ask was if you could just talk a little bit about your career, like where did it start and sort of, where did it go?
Okay, so it started in school. So I went along to a track meet, just kind of a casual inter-school thing. And as I mentioned earlier, just found that I really enjoyed it. My blood sugars looked a bit better and it was just a positive experience, thinking about the diabetes management, but not thinking about the label of diabetes and what somebody can and can't do. And then I got myself a coach and started training a little bit more regularly. So this was probably about the age of 17 now, and started doing competitions. So not initially winning. I was doing, when you're younger, you tend to do a few more events. So I was doing hurdles and long jump as well. I do not have the coordination for hurdles, so I took that out and the jumping and just stuck with sprinting. So I got my kind of my main coach then, Tom, who was just superb. He took the diabetes in his stride, never treated me any differently, but he knew if I ever said to him, I need a minute just to manage my diabetes, he'd keep an eye on me, but he'd let me manage it myself. So that kind of escalated then to training 6 days a week, on track, on sand dunes, in the gym, which all behave differently for the diabetes. But once you kind of get to grips with that, then, and have a bit of a routine, prepare well, it's all kind of possible. I think it's always been really important to recover well in terms of nutrition to manage the diabetes, because I think a lot of people think about, you know, understandably, the worries of going low during the exercise, but you know, the effects of exercise can last up to 72 hours. So, but the trick is, if you recover well with the right amount of carbohydrates and everything else and a balanced meal, then the risk of kind of hypos is greatly decreased. And so I started off then doing Welsh Schools Internationals, and I broke a few records there in the 100 and 200 meter sprints. Then I got into the kind of the Welsh junior team, the Welsh senior team then. I won quite a few British medals sprinting as well. I particularly loved indoor competing, in the 200 metres was my favourite. So it was a real privilege to kind of win those kind of events. And I've just really enjoyed athletics, truth be told. It's been a lot of fun. It's been a great opportunity to meet other people as well, to kind of get to know my body on a different level. Things have only slowed down because of the eclampsia postpartum, but you know, it's something that I probably will go back to, but when I feel ready, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And how has diabetes impacted your athletics? Has there been any positive aspects of that?
Well, I think in a way it's all a positive aspect, because I wouldn't have taken up athletics necessarily if I didn't have diabetes, and I don't know what it's like to do athletics without diabetes. So it's kind of, this is all I know and all I've experienced. But I think it's been a really good leveler that, you know, I've always trained alongside people who don't have diabetes, not for any particular reason, just there haven't been other athletes with the condition. And so knowing that I was just as capable as everybody else is just really important, I think. It's been a good journey.
And how do you feel when you're competing?
In terms of diabetes or just generally?
Yeah, just generally.
I just love it. Absolutely love competing. I think that you sometimes have to be made. There we go. Sorry, my speaker went off then. I was just saying that, I absolutely love athletics. I love competing. I like individual sports. I don't mind the pressure. I work really well under pressure, and I like that the pressure is on me. So I think one of the things I really loved about athletics, and it's a little bit like diabetes for the most part, that if you put in a lot of hard work, then you tend to get the results out. So athletics was a good lesson in that, being able to kind of put in the time, put in the effort. And ultimately as well, I hate to say it, but diabetes does like routine. And because I had the routine of training, then I think that helps balance things out as well.
And do you feel like you have any sort of specific strategies around like the food to eat or sort of like routines around that?
Yeah, so I would say before I became a dietitian, I certainly tried my best to get to know the different types of carbohydrates because they're all a bit of a toolkit, really. So, I would use slower acting, slower release carbohydrates around my sport because they help you store the muscle glycogen that gives you energy later on. But then when you're looking at things like insulin on board and coming up to the activity itself, you want more of the fast acting carbohydrates, but being aware that they burn off quite quickly. So getting to know that was really important. Having regular meals before kind of training, because for the most part I always trained in the evening, so I'd always have my regular meals and snacks before training. During training, I'd never be afraid to top up the fast acting carbohydrates. So I know that's something that people have shared with me that they always worry about, that you're doing physical activity and you don't really want to be eating at the same time because you're trying to be healthy, but you've got to give your body what it needs. And something I've learned from training with people without diabetes is that you still need to fuel your body for performance, and having diabetes doesn't make that any different. And then post-exercise, then kind of it's a tricky concept to explain, kind of over audio rather than physically. But basically, when you're training, I found that you burn off a certain amount of carbohydrates that if you don't put back in the tank, will kind of drop your blood sugars. So yes, it's also to do with your how much insulin is on board, but that's the reason why, say, somebody might reduce their insulin compared to what they normally have for the meal post exercise, because you're allowing your body to replenish the carbohydrates that it's used up during the activity. So I think that was a real secret weapon as well, as I mentioned earlier, just refueling properly and kind of having the balance of good health. So having food from each of the food groups, but also being aware of, the usefulness of carbohydrates, as I mentioned, and protein for recovery as well.
Excellent. So here's the one question that we've just sort of got to know that to know about is about you being a torchbearer for the London Olympics.
Yeah,
So
that
how did
was.
that come about?
Oh my goodness. So I'd already started volunteering for Diabetes UK Cymru for a few years before, and then they decided very, very kindly to nominate me to carry the Olympic torch. And initially I was just thrilled to be nominated, and then I didn't hear anything for absolutely ages from London 2012. And then literally probably about 2 weeks before, they gave me a call to say, do you want to be the main one on the main stage in Cardiff? So I was like, well, yeah, that'd be lovely. Not really knowing what, I'd never been that involved in a torch ceremony before. And then yeah, it turned out to be in front of 20,000 people. So fair turnout, really. But just a wonderful, wonderful experience to be able to show people with and without diabetes that you can still do things in sport or whatever it is that you want to do. Diabetes doesn't need to get in the way. I think that was just a great opportunity to be able to share that on a wide scale, really. And then the Olympic torch is, in pride of place, and it just represents so much to me, from a volunteering point of view, from like a overcoming hurdles point of view. And it was lovely being able to, I got invited to schools and athletics clubs afterwards. And again, it was that chance to raise awareness of diabetes and hopefully show that if diagnosis did come to people, that it wasn't, you know, things were still kind of bright in the future.
Wow. I am so jealous, Mel, because I was London 2012 was the best, one of the best periods of my life. Sort of like I've held torches and stuff, but I can't imagine what it was like.
Oh, it just, London 2012, as you say, as an experience, was just so sensational. It was, I've been to Olympics to kind of, as a spectator before, I've been to Commonwealth Games, World Athletic Championships, but London 2012 was the one.
Yeah.
It was just so well organised. The atmosphere was just incredible. Yeah. You know, being able to get tickets for everything you wanted to see if you balloted. And yeah, it was just sensational. I completely get what you're saying, that it was a wonderful experience because it was the whole year, wasn't it? It was the build-up. Yeah. It was the Olympics. It was the afterwards. It was just sensational.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Mel. I'm sorry we overran. We always overrun. But I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been lovely. Thank you for talking about so many areas. And I know there were so many more we could have spoken about.
Well, we'll just have to have another one. I mean, this one has been special. We've kicked off Diabetes Week in the right way, but let's do it again. It's been wonderful.
Thanks ever such a lot, Mel. We really do appreciate it.